Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the IDFC First Bank Q1 FY22 earnings conference call hosted by ICICI Securities Limited. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Kunal Shah from ICICI Securities Limited. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thank you, Faizan, and good evening, everyone present on the call. This is Kunal Shah from ICICI Securities. Today we have with us Mr. V. Vaidyanathan, Managing Director and CEO, Mr. Sudhanshu Jain, CFO and Head Corporate Center, and Mr. Saptarshi Bapari, Head Investor Relations from IDFC First Bank to discuss their Q1 FY22 earnings. Over to you, sir.
Okay, good evening, everybody. It's just a great pleasure for me to speak to all of you today. I haven't had analyst conference calls for like 10 years in a row. In Capital First, we started that at 2010, and it got the name of Capital First in 2012. And 8 years went by, you know, we were giving out our quarterly results, and then we spoke to television channels, and that was it. After the merger of the bank in 2018 to today, again, we've not had any conference calls. So for me, let me just at least after 10 years, it's re-entry into this process. I hope I can do justice to your expectations. Now, with regard to our bank, I think we came into being in a new avatar as IDFC First Bank in December of 2018. And at that point of time, we made certain very specific guidance as what we will achieve in 5 years. The key thing was that at that point of time, Capital First was something like about 28,000 crores of you know, loan book, 30,000 crores of AUM. IDFC Bank was about like 75,000 crores of loan book, and together it is coming to about 1,000 crores. And at that point of time, our bank had, naturally, we were just a startup bank. 2 years ago, we had got a license. So really, we did not have much of deposits. We really didn't have a really good picture about how the P&L of the merged entity would roll out to be. I mean, we had a plan, we had a thought when we did the merger, but, you know, as all of us know in life, as we turn out, as it turns out, in the next 4 or 5 years, there could all be lots of variances in our plans and thoughts and all that we factor for. So we didn't have much of a, but we had a reasonable picture. So we gave a 5-year picture with the limited visibility we had. And that 5-year picture, I'm happy to say that we are broadly on course on every one of the parameters that we set out at that point of time. And I'm happy to say also that we haven't wavered one bit from the original direction we set for ourselves. Along the way, we never got excited to think, oh my God, I want to do insurance, so let me do mutual fund, let me start doing corporate banking again in a big way, let me start doing infrastructure, it's very profitable. So, you know, we haven't moved this way or that way. We made a plan, we announced it to all of you, and we stuck to it. And let me just say that the guidances we gave at that point of time were broadly on 5 parameters with the limited visibility we had. Number one, we said that on the we recognized that the key issue the bank had at that point of time was the fact that on the liability side, we had let me say about 5,200 crores of CASA deposits, and on the lending side, we had close to like 1,03,000 or 1,04,000 crores, and including other liabilities, probably even bigger. And therefore, you know, and therefore, including on the liability side, I'm saying it was even bigger than 1 lakh. It was like 1,40,000 or 1,50,000 crores. So this is a very, very low CASA percentage. And the key call we took at that point of time was that we don't, you know, we don't want to grow the loan book. We have to first get the liabilities in order. You know, I've been in banking circles long enough to know that the key issue that that can really put a bank under risk is really not the asset side, the liability side is probably even more important than anything. So the first 2 years, I think in a very single-minded focused way, we focus on the liability side. But coming back to the guidance front, we gave a CASA guidance that we will be 30% in 5 years. You know, we've gone past that number now. Second thing is that we said that we'll put out close to about 800 to 900 branches in 5 years. It was just a number that we thought would be right. It was no science to it. And, you know, we've come to close to about 600 branches now. We've given 2025 for 800, 900 branches, I think should not be difficult if you want to put that many branches at all. Because along the way, as we're figuring out, digital is becoming a big play and all that. Then the third thing that along the way we figured out that the customer deposits, we just don't want customer deposits because let me again go back in time, it's important. We had close to about, say, 30,000 crores of corporate deposits, about 28,000 crores of certificates of deposits. All of you know that with both of these can be brittle if taken in very high measure. And that's when we said we got to pay down these deposits before a crisis strikes, not after suddenly there's a liquidity problem. So one of the things we came up with was that we want a top 20 depositors concentration to come down dramatically because we just don't want to be beholden to top 20 depositors bank who might just call and ask for the money. So at that point of time at merger, we had 40% of the top 20 depositors. 40% of our deposits came from 20 depositors. So we, at least as in a strategic sense, we saw this as a big issue. And then we said that we got to bring this down. So we gave a guidance that we want to bring this down to 5% in 2024-25. I'm really happy to say that we've come up to 9% already. And really at 9%, we feel very, very safe. And of course, in due course, we'll take it down to 5% there. The other thing was the certificate of deposit. We gave some guidance on that front. We said that our certificate deposit in March was 28,000, not in December. December is 22,000. So we said 28,000 had to bring it down. Now we are, hovering around maybe 5,000 to 6,000 crores. Frankly, we're comfortable even at 10,000 crores. We just, and it's pretty inexpensive. The reason we're not taking it is not because of any reason, just because we don't have the need for it. But anyway, it's already come down. The first is that along the way, we introduced one more requirement in terms of a guidance, that is in terms of average liquidity ratio. Because again, what does a bank in is not anything else. It's basically liquidity and diversification or lack of it. So therefore, the average, liquidity ratio, we say we want to be greater than 110%, but really right now we are running upwards of 166% last quarter. Then the next set of guidance we gave, so all that I described to you was on the liability side. Now I move over to the asset side. On the asset side, at merger, our retail book was 36,236 crores, and we had guided that we will take this to 1 lakh crore in 5 years. Frankly, we have to say we are on track because it's only June of 21. It's just like 2.5 years, and we already touched 72,766 crores. So a lakh crores is just a hop, skip, and jump. It's not even, we should count it as achieved practically for all practical purposes. Then the next thing we set for ourselves as a goal as a retail, as a percentage of total assets, because we really feel that our capabilities clearly are on the retail side in a very significant sense. One, because from the net worth point of view, the big banks like the big four have net worth of maybe 1.5 lakh crore or 2 lakh crore or 2.5 lakh crore, and with our net worth of 17,000-20,000 crore, we really didn't could not believe or we did not fancy ourselves being any serious players in the corporate banking side with a relatively, let me say, mid-sized bank's net worth. And it couldn't have been very smart to go head up against them or try to take them on in terms of pricing and things like that. So that is not, we didn't call that a strength. We said that we will do it in an opportunistic way, but really it is not the big game for us. So we said that if focus on the retail side, frankly 20,000 crores is really a lot of capital, and we could really achieve big things. The second thing, of course, is very, very diversified. I've personally done this for like close to about 25, 28 years, and I just find that with all my experience, I just find that you have an odd cycle here or there, but in the longer run, these are end, net-net, these are end of the day, individuals are borrowing, individuals bother about the credit bureau, individuals, you know, they don't have a cover or a shell of a company which can have some limited liability and they cannot, you know, they don't have escape, those escape routes. They have the personal, you know, in terms of the size of the relationship, you know, the it's always, I mean, the strength of the relationship with the individual customer is much stronger. So for many reasons, we wanted to retail. So so therefore, that we set as a target of about 30, at that time it was 35% at merger. Pre-merger, standalone bank was some 39%. Because of the merger with Capital First, which was like 90% retail, the blend became 35. And then we said it will be 70% in 5 years. But we already touched the 68% as we speak today, including the PSL book and a PSL buyout book. So you can treat this as good as on track. The fourth thing is we said is on the wholesale side, we said we want to bring ourselves down below 40,000 crore because we I don't fancy ourselves, like I said, being a very large corporate banker. So, I mean, we'll be still be relevant to the customers we want to serve, but in the size and proportion as relevant to our network. So, so our target at that point of time, we said, was less than 40,000 crores. I'm happy to say we're already at 32,000 crores. Then on the wholesale side, we also said that our top 10 borrowers as a percentage of total funded assets, we wanted it to be, at that time was 12.8%, really to give 13% of our you know, if top 10 borrowers are going to have 13-14% of our funded assets, it doesn't feel very comfortable. So we wanted to bring it down below 5, we already reached 5.8. We gave some certain guidances on gross and net NPA. We said that our, you know, our wish list is to keep a gross NPA around 2 to 2.5%. Net NPA is 1 to 1.2%. As of now, as we speak, the gross NPA is 4.61% and net is 2.32. But really, 2024-25 is a long way away. I have no doubt in my mind that we will get that to the numbers of 2% gross and 1% net we talked about. Then the next thing was, so all the stuff, the second set of stuff I talked about was all about assets. The third set of stuff we talked about is earnings. Now, again, you know, we were at a merger situation. The earnings on Capital First, yield on the book was close to about 16.5%. Our cost of funds was something like about 9-ish odd percent, maybe a little less than that. And we had net worth, so all put together, we're making a NIM of like 8.5-9%. And we're making a return on equity of about 15%. But 15% is on stock. But if you go to the last page of the presentation, if you got an opportunity to flip to go through the presentation, basically quarter on quarter on quarter for close to about 5 years at a stretch, our return on equity was growing on the whole book, which means that the incremental return on equity we were getting, not the return on equity was 15, which by itself was not bad, but the incremental return on equity we were getting every quarter on our book was upwards of like 18 to 20%. Which means the incremental capital consumed and the incremental profit we were making out of that incremental capital. So we were frankly very, very happy that, look, if Capital First had been a standalone entity and theoretically perhaps got a bank license or something, then you would just keep, you know, pressing the same lever again and again and keep, you know, pushing yourself towards that sort of a ROE. And that would have been a kind of a desired ROE where we feel that it's an annuity institution by itself. And you can raise some capital from time to time, but you really don't have to depend on it for growth. So that is a broad plan. But anyway, that is on one side. On the other side of the equation, on IDFC Bank side, it was a good institution, and I'm quite proud that this is the institution we merged with, and all things good in terms of brand and the governance and all that. But on the earnings front, I think it was a big challenge because it was an infrastructure DFI. And the DFI, by definition, actually borrows at high rates. For example, you know, like, you know, some 8.75% was common to borrow. And there's infrastructure loans to it. Infrastructure, you know, if it's good infrastructure, it gets repriced itself downwards quickly. If it's a difficult asset, it stays on your books forever. Nobody buys it from you. And then, you know, set up cost of a new bank, which was incurred by the bank. So there were these set of challenges that the bank had at that point of time because it was also a new bank setting up, set up costs and all that. So there's a slide somewhere inside, but there's a blend of the half-year merged pro forma financials of the two institutions shown somewhere, but it wasn't very pretty on merger. It was kind of negative. And from that situation, we said, okay, what does the story look like? So from that situation, we gave a pretty clear guidance that we will touch 15% in 5 years. I know most of you are quite concerned, or maybe are concerned about our return on equity, because the numbers in terms of earnings have not kept pace in terms of the pre-provisioning operating profit. But of course, that has to be seen in the context of where we started from. But still, I think you may have a concern and talk to me about it today. But at that point in time, with the limited visibility, we gave a guidance of 15%. I'm happy to say that broadly, we are very much on track on that. And later in the time, if you get an opportunity, we'll describe to you how. So this is it. Basically, these were the five or six, not five actually, to be very precise. They're about maybe 15-odd guidances that we've given, but they belong to four categories, which is liabilities, assets, earnings, diversification, and of course, a fifth one which we haven't talked about, which is important, is capital. The truth is that we did not give any specific guidance on capital. Maybe it didn't occur to us at that point of time. I can't recollect. But basically, when we look ahead from here on, we can make some very specific guidances on the capital front also. Right now, our capital is 20,170 crores. Our capital adequacy is 15.56% as we speak. The guidance we'd like to give, of course, is that our capital adequacy will not go below 13%. That would be our broad guidance and wish, the way we run a bank. And therefore, if you see that our capital is dipping below that level, you can know that we're coming to the market for capital. So this is the broad stuff. But you can think of it like a guidance given now, not then. But you can pack it from here for the rest of the 3 years that are left into 2025. So, you know, that is a very quick brief I'd like to give you about what has progressed during the last few years, let me say 2.5 years. And really, in 2.5 years, I really think we've come, really hell of a long way. I really don't think that anybody really guessed that we'll get to 50% CASA in 2.5 years. That too for a large bank to get there. So we are, that's how we are playing our cards. We're very straight about how we do our business. In fact, you may recall that the first five quarters after the merger, not one, not two, five full straight quarters, every quarter we discovered a problem. One quarter it is Vivan Housing, another quarter is Reliance Capital, another quarter it is a telecom company, another quarter it was a DTA, where it got reworked, and another quarter it was an infrastructure company. But really, I tell you, it's not an easy job for any CEO to come out there and say, look, okay, this quarter we didn't, we made a loss. It's just not a pleasant thing to do at all. But no matter what the pressure was, we just looked straight into the eye, straight into the camera, and said, "This is what the numbers are." Most of it, I guess, came from legacy, but that's not the point here. So we do play straight, and we want to play straight going forward also. And I think it has given us a lot of confidence in the way we would do our business, with the way we look at our incremental economics. I really personally don't get so rattled about what the current economics of any institution are. I didn't get rattled even when it was capital first, when it was loss-making for 3 years, even after I had touched it. So basically, I always look at incremental earnings. It's very important because end of the day, the incremental earnings become the book when you grow it faster than the rest of the book. So incremental earnings for a bank, we feel, are pretty strong. Our incremental cost of funds is now coming down below 5. Our lending on the retail side is pretty strong. We'll talk about it. And incremental return on equity is, according to me, really very good. So when that incremental becomes the book, then you know that this bank is headed for a really into a good space. So I'd like to really, with that very quick brief, I'd like to stop here. And I'd like to, open it up for any discussion. Thank you, friends, and nice to speak to all of you. I got with me Sudhanshu. Sudhanshu is the CFO and the head corporate center for the bank. And I got Saptarishi, who many of you may have interacted with. He's the head of investor relations with us. Sudhanshu, you might want to say hello.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining this call. It's a pleasure taking this call and having this conversation with all of you. Saptarishi.
Yeah, thanks everyone for joining. We look forward to your questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. We will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and 1 on their touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and 2. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. The first question is from the line of Pritesh from Prabhudas Lilladher. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Hello, Pritesh.
Hi. Good evening. Sir, I had a couple of questions. First is, wanted to ask, what will be our average SAR rate now? If you can give the same for last year and last quarter as well, if you can share that number.
You mean interest rate?
Yeah. I mean, the interest rate is obviously there on the website, but the average rate, SAR rate for us right now will be what on the book?
Yeah, about, let me say 4.8%.
4.8?
And the same...
4.8%, yeah. And the same for last quarter will be?
We reduced rates by about 100 basis points, you know, last quarter. So think about like 5.8.
Fair enough. Can you also give a breakup of client size, possible?
Yes, we can.
No problem.
Sudhanshu, what's the performance right now in absolute terms?
Yeah. 65 or? CASA ratio is...
Not ratio, CASA in absolute terms.
Yeah, client CASA breakup, sir.
46,000. Sorry, you're asking about CASA deposit?
No, I have the CASA deposit, the breakup of between CA and SA, current account and saving account.
CA is about 6,000 odd crores.
6,000 crores is the SA?
Yeah.
Okay. And sir, just as a strategy, just wanted to ask, in the presentation, I could see the corporate book is growing. We've seen some of the segments growing by about 20% year on year, or quarter on quarter, there's some growth. What is this strategy there now? I mean, we've been reducing exposures there. Now, from here, you see that at least the non-infra wholesale book growing, or you see you feel it is cautious. You made some comments on it, but can you just a little bit give a highlight how you think about it?
See, on the corporate side, like I said, you know, corporate banking belongs to someone who really has very low cost of funds, straightforward. You know, the big banks like ICICI, HDFC, Axis, they are naturals into it because they pay 3% up to 50 lakhs and 3.5% above that. So they really sit on very low CASA rate, cost of funds. And then, you know, a large corporate really asks for really fine prices. So it kind of naturally belongs to the, let me say, the big folks. So as far as we are concerned, we like corporate banking. But like I said, in proportion to our network, and secondly, with regard to our ability to get a reasonable risk reward, we really are very sensitive not to have a blow up of corporate banking on our hands. Now, I can tell you I am very sensitive about that. It would be a very fair estimate if you were to think that, you know, there would be, let me just say that we're very careful about it. And therefore, we do corporate loans, but where we feel that fundamentally there is a good risk available, good risk meaning that where we feel comfortable with the risk and it's coming at a reasonable price. We don't want to be priced out of the market, but at a price that is appropriate to our cost of funds. So that's one thing. Secondly, by the way, in corporate banking, we are also pretty strong in, we have really fantastic corporate banking solutions in terms of technology. We are good in cash management solutions. We, you know, we provide fantastic trade facilities across the country, and because we are a universal bank, we get fee income from Forex, the transaction banking fees. We like the business for its wholesomeness, but like I said, we want to do it in the proportion to our size and network. And the last comment on corporate banking, to give a specific guidance on how the book will evolve, given a choice, we'd like to maintain the book. We don't want to run it down any further. That's not our wish list. So if you tell us that would you like to keep it 35,000 crores for a while, yeah, of course we'd like to keep it. This is not a rundown book like infrastructure book is. We like it, and we like the team, and we like everything. If you're not able to do it, you can think of it like more like lack of an, our inability to spot a deal which meets our risk reward and net worth criteria. But we'll probably keep it there.
Great. Last question. Just wanted number on slippages, if you can provide that as well. Fresh slippages for the quarter.
Yeah. Slippages for the quarter was about 2,800 crores. This included one large lumpy exposure on a toll account where this the slippage was 850-odd crores. This account was already part of our identified standard list, and unfortunately it has slipped into NPA during the current quarter. We see payments happening on this account, but a bit delayed. We expect recovery to happen on this account in due course. On the retail front, out of this 2,800 crores, the slippages were about 1,800 odd crores. At the same time, we had recoveries and upgrades during the quarter, which was roughly about one-third of this number. And so net slippages is about 1.5-1.6% in retail.
Thank you, sir. That was great. Thank you. All the best.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Rohit Jain from Tara Capital Partners. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Am I audible?
Very much, Rohit.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for doing the call. Much appreciated and much needed. Just one question on asset quality. I see that your retail gross NPA and net NPA actually came down sequentially. Now in a quarter where, you know, the best of NBFCs like Bajaj Finance, Chola, everybody reported a decent sequential jump, and so did the best of banks. I'm just a bit intrigued as to how, our NPA in the retail segments are coming down sequentially. So can you please throw some light there?
Basically, you see provisions and write-off, they go off the balance sheet. So that's how this comes down. In reality, we've had, provisions to take through the P&L. Basically, the provision doesn't go off, but write-off goes off the balance sheet. So we had write-offs to take this quarter.
So can you please help us understand how much were the write-offs?
Yeah, write-off on retail was about 1,400 crores during the quarter.
Okay, so basically we had slippages of about 1,800 crores, recoveries of about 600 crores, and write-offs of about 1,400 crores in the retail segment.
Yeah, that's correct. Got it.
And another related question on retail is, I know we haven't done too much of a restructuring as yet, but is there anything in the pipeline? So what's the outlook there? And B, do we envision any further write-offs in the coming quarter?
Sorry, on your restructuring, so we have disclosed that number in the press release that we have restructured outstanding standard pool of 1.8% on retail. And this was about 0.9% in the previous quarter. So incremental is about 1% during the quarter.
Okay. And is there anything more in the pipeline?
Not significant restructuring we expect in Q2.
And as far as the first question and write-offs are concerned, the best way to assess the quality of our portfolio, I guess, of any portfolio for that matter, is to see three numbers together. The gross NPA, the net NPA, and the provisions. Because all of you are seasoned bankers, seasoned people, you'd know that if a bank were to take provisions, to that extent, the net NPA comes down. So having a low end gross or net is not a measure of success. It is the measure of success what provisions we take. So our guidance is for this year is as follows. We think that our estimates are that credit loss, including the write-off that has happened in the first quarter, the credit loss for this financial year we are targeting at 2.5%. And if and for our kind of healthy yields, we have frankly 2.5% will be quite comfortable. I must tell you that even pre merger with the bank, Capital First always had close to about 2.75% of credit losses, and the yields, as long as the yields were commensurate and this 2.75 was consistent, life was fine. So as of now, for this financial year we're targeting 2.5%. For next financial year we are guiding for 2%. So as if we can get that number, then at the gross and net NPA, whatever you're seeing, I think it's a pretty comfortable number.
Okay, thanks. And one last question on NIMS. Given that you have already reduced your savings account rates and the rates market-wise have sort of bottomed out, do we expect NIMS to keep inching up from here, or is 5.5 a level where we think we are comfortable from a risk-reward metric?
It will broadly be here, but it could still inch up from here, because basically the incremental economics of the bank are earning us greater than more NIM than 5.5%, at least in the retail side. Basically, retail, the incremental lending rate, borrowing rates are like something like under 5%, and the incremental lending rate are currently upwards of 14%. So we are getting incremental of it's pretty strong. You can do the math for yourself. So but this is a story in the retail side. The wholesale, of course, doesn't give this kind of names. But blend, it could still inch up from here.
Okay, I'll come back in the queue with further questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Participants, to ask a question, you may press star and one. The next question is from the line of Prakhar Agarwal from Edelweiss. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, sir. A few questions from my side. First, can you help me understand where this 1800 crore slippages in retail coming from? Which segment are we seeing this sort of number? So if I analyze that number, probably 10% of run rate on slippage on retail, that is quite a lot. So where is this segment, which segment of retail is this coming from?
We have seen three segments actually which have contributed more to this. One is the wheels segment, basically vehicles. And let me say our two-wheeler business had more slippages. Second was, the commercial vehicle business, the used car business, basically the vehicles category of stuff. And second was the JLG business, which is the microfinance book that we have in our rural areas.
Okay. And when I look at write-offs, 1,400 crores is a significant number. What is the thought process behind writing these assets off? And which segment is this 1400 coming from? Predominantly JLG business or wheels and JLG combined?
All put together. And even on the other businesses, which are supposedly secured businesses, we've had slippages. Whether it is, frankly, for that matter, all of wheels is secured only. And in due course, we're hoping to collect the money. I think one very, very important thing I think all of us should kind of note is as follows. How do we take provisions? Our provisions are very formula-based. We say, look, at 90 DPD, we've got to take so much percentage. At 120, we take off so much. And at 180, we take off 120, 150, and so on and so forth. There's a provision policy. Now, this is a quarter when throughout, April and May, country was on lockdown. Credit collectors could not go, customers were doing their business and they were not earning income. So at that point of time, when that situation occurs, then the whole portfolio, except the people who clear their checks, the people who return their checks, that set of portfolio tends to slide one bucket forward. A bucket meaning a stage, which is 0 to 30, 30 to 60, I'm calling each one of those a bucket. So it moves one bucket forward. When that happens, we have a formula. We take it through the P&L. Now, this is a pretty straightforward approach, And that's one of the reasons you see that, you know, you see that our provisions are high. But I want to point one very important thing to you. Just because the customer has moved over to 90 DPD and we have to take, say, 33% provision, does not mean the customer is not, I mean, doesn't mean we're going to really lose 33%. No. It's just the customer moved to that bucket. Now, if the customer also had a COVID problem, just like we had a COVID problem. So when the business recovers, customer will pay. And that money will come back. That is the reason we are guiding for this year. If you see, the 1400 by itself looks like a large number. But see the guidance we're giving for the full year. It's only 2.5% of credit average book. Why? Because these customers who go into the bucket continue to pay subsequent to sitting in the bucket. So we are definitely believing that these customers that we, for whom we are taking charge of to the P&L on a conservative basis today, a lot of them will pay in due course.
Sure, sir. That I understand. That's why I'm saying, what is the rationale for write-off? If you're so confident that they will be repaying, what was the rationale of writing it off at the first place?
No, it's a very good question. Again, write-off is a formula for us. We have a defined formula that, you know, we write off something at, say, let me pick a date, say 360 days or 240 days. There are some different products depending on ticket size, etc., have a different formula. So it's a formula. The formula doesn't distinguish you had a problem because of COVID or because of, you know, where a customer is because of COVID or because of any reason the customer couldn't pay, whatever the reason is. Formula is a formula is a formula. We just take it to the P&L. That's the end of the matter. But the important thing to note during the COVID situation is that customers are delayed, but they will pay. If somebody's moved to, say, fourth bucket is 90 to 120. We take 33%. But customer will stay that in that bucket, will continue to pay us maybe for 3 months, 5 months, 7 months. Some of them will pay two EMIs and come back to 31 to 60. Some of them will pay two EMIs and come down to maybe 0 to 30. So this is a accounting item, and for now, taken in a pretty straightforward manner, customer will still pay and we will recover this back to the P&L. And it is very possible that what we charge off to the P&L today will come back to us, say, 2 quarters, 3 quarters, 4 quarters from now. Remember, there's a customer, there's a real customer sitting out there. There's a real customer, there is a bureau, there is a rule of law, the customer has, dues payable to us, the customer, the moment customer cash flow comes, the customer will pay us. So this COVID-related provisions and COVID-related delinquency has to be treated a bit different than what was going on in pre-COVID times.
Okay. So just a couple of more questions. First, on your stress book that we have highlighted. Now, when I look at your stress book, the three assets, which is one wind power and one logistic company and third one is solar project, there is no movement at all in these sort of projects. And in two of them, we are only carrying, in solar project, we are not carrying any provision. And on wind power, we are only carrying 25% provision. So why is there first no repayments in there? And are we comfortable with this sort of provisioning given the fact that there is no repayment at all?
No, as you speak, we got to pull out the piece of paper so that we can give you a more straight answer. Just give us 10 seconds. Pull out the sheet. Are you referring to the stress list that we put out over and above the NPA?
Yeah, stress list that we took out. So I was just comparing your last quarter number and this quarter number, and there was no movement in the exposure for these three assets.
Okay.
And within these three, we are not, for two of them, we are not carrying any.
Now, if you see the stress asset page, we haven't named the clients, but we kind of described given some clues or given some name, given some description. Now, without getting the specific name, because maybe Sudhanshu can help with the specific question, let me just say that overall, if you see, this number is 1371 crore. And against 1371 crore, that is the, just for the benefit of others who are hearing the program, let me explain the question to them, otherwise they'll be confused. One is an NPA. That is what we've disclosed, we have taken our provisions and all that. Over and above what is disclosed in NPA as a bank, given in page 100, I think in the report, we also have, not 100, sorry, in page 48, we also define the entities which is on our books where we see stress where we have taken provision that is not yet NPA. So that's what this gentleman here is referring to. So let me say that on that front, our outstanding exposure is 1,371 crore. Our provision is already 915 crore. So that's like only 400 crores uncovered on a exposure of 1,371 crore. We feel overall pretty good about that. Now let me just add one more input, and then that will tell you the direction we are headed. In March of 2019, our identified stressed assets, i.e. over and above declared NPA, identified stressed asset was 4,138 crore. See the direction. Today that number is only 1,371 crore. And at that time, the provision was 957 crore on 4,000 crore. That has a provision cover of 23%. Today on 1,371, we have a provision of 915 crore. So the short point is that notwithstanding the specific account you flagged, because we got to think, understand the account a little better. But overall, let me say that whatever is outstanding there is well provided.
No, sir, the only point in asking this question was that even if there is a timing difference and a couple of these projects wherein we have not provided to an extent of 67% looks good from an overall perspective, but when I look at 2-3 assets wherein there has not been any repayments, the coverage over there is essentially next to nothing. So there could be a quarter or so wherein if this
okay, we got the question. As we speak, are you referring to the account that is shown outstanding exposure of 251 crores?
No, so wind power, which is showing an outstanding of 157 crores, and solar project, which is showing a outstanding of 83 crores. Now, if I look at provisions, wind power has 25% provision, and solar project has nothing in sort of PCR that we have created for that.
So, the short answer is that for this one on the solar project, though we have put in the stressed list because the group is stressed, the fact is that projects are performing well, and they are servicing the debt regularly.
The
sponsor is undergoing a resolution process, they put it as a stress, but as far as we are concerned, we are getting paid on the 83 crore. Similarly, on the wind power 157 crore you are talking about, this account servicing was earlier delayed, but now it is showing improved financials. They are servicing debt from cash flow of the project. So if this was truly a stressed account where they were not servicing the cash flow and they were troubled and all that, we would have probably taken more provision, but it's not so. They're paying us.
Thank you, Mr.
And it's 51783.
Thank you. Mr. Agarwal, may we request that you return to the question queue for follow-up questions. Thank you. The next question is from the line of Seshadri Sen from Alchemy Capital. Please go ahead.
Hi, Rajanathan. Hi. Great to have you on the call. It's good practice to start. Three questions I had. First is on asset quality. The road project which has become an NPA, if I get it right, I think you had 18% coverage on that according to your last quarter's presentation. Was there any incremental provisioning on it when it slipped into NPAs?
No, we did not take any incremental provisions.
And so the 1800 crore provisioning is largely on your retail book because of COVID. Is my broad understanding right? No.
We also this includes some advanced COVID advanced provisions we've taken for possible delinquencies.
So that's about 300 crores.
Yeah. So it's not all of it is not retail. But to the earlier question on the 874 or 854 crore account, you can see that that is now displaying the NPA. Let me just tell you what that account is so you'll get some comfort. Frankly, we feel that we will get, there will not be any material loss on it as of today. That 850 crores is showing as NPA. Technically, it is an NPA. But that account for the last many years, like ever since the merger happened, and even prior to pre-merger days, this account has always been delayed between as an SMA2. And this is a operating, road toll project in Mumbai, and they have cash flow, and they have been servicing like for 2.5 years now. So therefore, we believe that even if it is NPA, so be it. It's a timing issue. I mean, not so be it. Of course, I wish it not happened. But the fact is that that this money will come back to us. So so this is academically an NPA, technically an NPA. But eventually, when we wake up, many you know, few years from now, all this money will come back because there's a real cash flow for the project.
And you had an 18% provisioning on that going into the first at the end of the fourth quarter.
Nothing to worry. Eventually, the money will come back, and you know.
Understood. And the large telecom exposure that you have, is that something that could be guided for 2.5%? So something happened to that. I presume then that is an a risk beyond the 2.5% or that you're expecting this year.
Which one?
The Vodafone?
The telecom company. Yeah, that telecom company we didn't refer to 2.5 because this 2.5 we're referring to normal course of business. So if you take the total provisions we take last year and then you divide by the last year's average book, and then you take total provisions we're expecting to take this year. We've already taken 1,800 crores, and then we're planning to, you know, our own internal guess is probably somewhere like about 2,900 to 3,000 crores is the total provision for this year, which means that, you know, let me just say this 18 is, let me say, we've already taken it a substantial portion in the first quarter. So, but if you take that number and divide by this year's average book, you will get the number at 2.5%. Next year, our expected, based on how the book is behaving, our indicators are showing, we take that and then you divide that by next year's average book. We believe the next year will come to 2% or so, or maybe a little below that. So our broad philosophy is that, you know, we've taken quite a few hits in our lives in the last 2 years. This is not the first one. You know, we've taken Divan, Reliance Capital, you know, there was a large infrastructure, you know, you name it, you know, this unfortunate incident of that case in Bangalore. We have powered through with a core model. You know, it is very important to think about it like that. That you know, you have some issues on the side, you deal with the issue, then they go away in time. You know, they become small objects in the rear mirror. But the core incremental business model is very important. And if we can grow the bank from here on 20% year-on-year, and then, you know, get the incremental economics the way I'm saying on the retail side, then it solves, I mean, it according to us, it'll become turn out to be a terrific bank.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate that you recognize everything up front rather than kick the can down the road. Switching tracks, I saw that your CASA in absolute amounts quarter on quarter has not grown. Is that an impact of your cut in your savings bank rates? And do you think that's a short term thing? And you know, over a little bit of time, your customer base will get accustomed to this lower rate. Has there been a flight when you initially cut rates? You know, just some color on how your CASA base responded to your cuts, and would that, you know, slow down your growth over the rest of the year, or you think it will come back later?
No, it's a good question and relevant to the relevant to the situation. Now, you know, we frankly have a fantastic franchise on the liability side, and I do think that customers stay with us and stick with us for our service. You know, we have a very genuine approach towards this customer first. We're insanely fetished about that. We are, and all that has actually helped us grow our CASA. And of course, you know, on a very attractive interest rate we paid, all that combined to, you know, grow our CASA, I think, quite fast over the last 3 years. Now, when we started the quarter, we just had a lot of cash, and all of that cash was lying, you know, earning us pretty low rates in reverse repo and all that. So we actually took a call that even if some deposit comes off as a result of this rate cut, it's probably a good thing in the short run, because we wanted, not short run, but we wanted some amount of deposits to flow out, because that kind of liquidity, excess liquidity was bothering us. So we planned it well, and so this was very much factored for. So our belief is that, you know, factored for, meaning it's not come down, by the way, it's still grown from 45,000 crores to 46,000 crores. It's like, it's still up, but marginally up. Yeah. Now, going forward, so the short point is it doesn't bother us because it was planned. Now, going forward, we feel this will start growing again. Maybe in the next quarter again, we don't need very much because we still have just too much of cash, which is deployed at very low rates. Therefore, even if it grows marginally in the quarter, i.e., July, August, September, we're quite happy with that. But after that, this machine will grow again. There's no doubt. I mean, it'll grow enough to feed our asset needs.
Your growth aspirations.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. And if I could squeeze in a third question on cost and, your cost. I don't know how you look at cost, whether it's cost income, cost to assets, or just simple OpEx growth. I know you're in technology in a very big way. So if you can give some color as to both in FY 2022 and, 2 to 3 years out, how your costs will shape up, because that's an, if your cost income is much higher than your peers, which is in part an opportunity as well, but, it would be useful to understand how you think about it both in the short and the medium term.
Cost is important. The way we think about it is a cost to income ratio, actually, to give you a simple answer. And as far as cost is concerned, our cost is concerned, it is basically, as you can well imagine, our bank started just maybe 5 years ago, and, it's been just in 2 years since the merger. So if you start at the 5,000 crore CASA and you're staring with a liability base of, I told you earlier, like 150,000 odd crores, I mean, if you're the CEO of a bank, I don't know what you'll do. You'll really run for the door and just quickly get the money in. So our strategy is very simple. At that point of time, we said, expense or no expense, just go and put the branches here and now, get the money in and retire the bulk deposits, like here and now. This was the broad thinking. So in the first 2 years, we went and set out, we put out our 350 odd branches, something like that. So 350 odd branches, and they're all costing us money. Of course, we also invest in technology, it costs us money. And any new startup bank, I'd imagine, starts first with expenses and, income comes in due course. Actually, let me say any business for that matter. So our expenses are kind of front-loaded because of the, we had to put up the branches and all that. And in due course, as the branches will become profitable, this cost to income will start looking better. And that's why when we're guiding for, when we gave a 5-year plan, we said, we'll come bring it down to 55%. I think it'll happen.
A quick clarification as to your cost structures, because your loan book is also high yielding. I've found that some of this, that also becomes a high variable cost business. So when your growth is very high, you see a slight pressure on your cost. When your growth slows down, you get some benefit. Has that also played out, or in your context, your branch costs are so high that that really doesn't matter?
No, you're bang on. It absolutely plays out because you see, imagine you're doing a business like, say, two-wheeler financing. Well, these are all very expensive businesses because, you've got this salesperson out there, he pays some commission to the dealer. These all come with their own variable expenses as well. So you're right, it's both. It's not only branches. Even the way our lending side has grown, you might have seen the numbers. At merger, we were just 36,000 crores of loan book. Today, we're 73,000 crores. Imagine in terms of disbursements, probably it's doubled since the time we merged. So all that, you pay the DSA, you pay the market, you have more variable costs and all that stuff. But the point is that, so you have the variable cost of setting up growing a lending business. It happens. It's also cost of branches. So all that is bunched together when it's come right now, the last 2 years. But the fact is that as we look ahead, let me say 1 year, 2 year, 3 year from now, the same cost structure tends to get leveraged on a much larger base. And, let me make an example. If there's a branch that we set up and today the running cost of the branch is, let me make it up, say 3 crores a year. And suppose the deposit of the branch is, say, 50 crores. Then your OpEx is 3 crores and 50 crores. Now, tomorrow the same 50 crores become 200 crores because just the passage of time and more customers come and all. But it's a deposit. Your cost doesn't go from 3 to 3 to 3 or maybe marginally more. So that's how the operating expenses play out. The last thing why our cost income ratio will come down, actually second last, is that, let me say that suppose this is the head office where I'm right now sitting and talking to you. The cost is the cost is the cost. Whether the balance sheet was 1 lakh crore or 2 lakh crore or 3 lakh crore, the cost is the same cost. So there are certain fixed costs that gets leveraged over a much larger book, so you'll see the percentage going. And I call it the second last because the last item is still on digitization, because we are doing our significant efforts on digitizing the bank and removing all the useless processes that come with, you know, making things straight through journeys, doing imaging and, you know, doing all that stuff, so which helps cut costs as well.
Thank you. Mr. Sen, may we request that you return to the question queue for follow-up questions. The next question is from the line of Anand Bhavnani from White Oak Capital. Please go ahead.
Thank you for the opportunity. Sir, just first to confirm the number, if I heard it well, of the CASA, 6,000 is CA and then 40,000 would be CA. Is that what I heard?
Other way around, other way around.
Yeah, okay, fine. 40,000 is time, 6,000 is fine. And sir, in terms of capital adequacy, you mentioned in opening remarks you keep it about 13, you are currently 15. So it seems like mathematically you would need to raise money. So any guidance, I presume by the end of the financial year you would be in the market. Is that the right expectation?
No, maybe 18, 24 months, maybe 18 months. We haven't, it doesn't look like we'll have that much need for capital that soon. Because we have still a lot of headroom to raise tier 2 if we really wanted to. I can't say wanted to, you know, we've got to watch out the price and all that, but we can. And also there is headroom yet.
Sure. And so in terms of retailizing the book, given the experience during the 2 waves of COVID, how do you see the, you know, relative proportion of different segments, the JLG, vehicles and home loans, going forward, how would you want this breakup to trend? And if you can give us some sense, maybe 2-3 years out, how would you want these sub-segments of retail to be in various proportions?
See, the way we think about it is that there are a certain set of businesses where we have very natural advantages and a good 10-year track record and scale and all that. So, and let me say our natural capabilities. Those businesses are, let me say, two-wheeler financing, consumer durable financing, let me say loan against property, even affordable home loan, business loans, and so on and so forth. So these kind of businesses, you know, it's a pattern of 10 years have gone by our side. And we know that if you do the business, at least at our kind of underwriting we were doing in Capital First, we knew that it was predictably giving us 2.75% as a credit loss, you know, give or take a little bit here and there. So, because you know, you play in those waters, you have this kind of losses. It just goes as part of that trade. And you had the yields to support it, and as long as this 2.75 is a stable number, we were always happy. You know, you lend at 16, you have OPEX of say 6%, you have credit loss of say 2.7% or 3%, and you have ROE of 3%, and you multiply by 7 times, and you make a, you know, 18 ROE. So that is how that game played. Now, and of course, I've got to add fees. I've got to add that. Now, as we become a bank, what we have started doing is there's a subtle change in our strategy. The core model and intellectual property we built on those businesses, that continues. I mean, we developed it for 10 years. We're not going to let go just because of being a bank. But what we have started doing is that we have started playing more in the safer segments, like the traditionally safer segment, like the prime home loans. So in the prime home loans, for example, now because our cost of funds has come down so much, we are also right out there in the prime home loan market lending at 6.9%. So in this segment, the credit loss, of they don't get much yield, but they don't have much credit loss at all. In fact, I'd say that hardly anything at all. So therefore, the blend of this book, which was giving 2.75% credit loss in Capital First, more because of the fact that we are more price competitive, we are playing the safer part of the respective businesses we do, our blended credit loss should now come down to 2%. I hope that explained to you why we believe 2 will come down to 2, and it is not just a number we are giving as a guidance without thinking through. We've thought it through, we've done our mathematics, we've done our analytics, we've done our flow analysis, we've seen our check bounce data, we've seen our vintage analysis, so we have enough data points to quadrangulate and come to the conclusion that we are comfortably headed to below 2% in credit loss. In fact, below, I should say.
And sir, the implicit then assumption here is that we will no longer ever be going back to the saving rate that we are in from here on. Like that's history for our saving rates. Will incrementally either be at these levels or they will, in terms of the desire to garner now no longer at the cost of the rates, right?
See, I don't think any leader or will ever try to box themselves in a position that they will never do this or never do that. You know, we'll always play to the occasion. Depending on the merit of the ball, we play our shots. But the directionally, if you ask me, which is the way I'd like to take the bank to, yeah, the chances are that we'll not like to go there.
Sure, sir. Thank you. I'll come back with you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Rohit Jain from Tara Capital Partner. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my questions again. Just wanted to get back to the write-off discussion that we had earlier in the call. Now, I understand you said that you're confident that you'll recover the money eventually, and at the same time you said that the write-offs happen in a formulaic manner, then let's say somebody is 240 or 300 days past due. So my question is that, you know, the COVID second wave maybe impacted someone for 60 days, but a customer who had already, been delinquent for about 200 days, what difference does it make? I mean, so the fact that you've taken a write-off, it's not something that, automatically we can assume that it will come back, because the customer was, even if we leave aside COVID wave 2, when he was delinquent for about 200 days, which is a long period of time.
Absolutely. No doubt. We're not saying every customer is going to pay you back, but we are talking of the timing issue. You know, customers who were always traditionally good customers, you know, for 3 years or 2 years they've been paying you, suddenly, you know, just because of COVID, they moved to bucket 30 to 60 or 60 to 90 or 90 to 20, they'll pay. A customer is already sitting on maybe 180 DPD and moved to now 210. Well, this is a pretty low chance that customer will pay.
So let me clarify. I was not talking about the other GNPA. I was talking about the discussion on the write-offs. And the customers who are getting written off are not sitting in the 30, 60, 90 days past due bucket. They are, as you said, sitting in the 200, 240 days past due bucket. So those are, so I am specifically talking about that write-off of 1,500 odd crores that you have taken. I mean, from where I see it, the chances of recovering anything from them should be absolutely remote, because they were, even before the COVID times, completely, let's say, the traffic code was not satisfactory at all.
No, it's a good question. The thing is that first of all, our write-off policy is more conservative. If you see a provisioning ratio, it's 50%. And it's not today. If you go back in time, like any time for 10 years, there's some disturbance in somebody's line. If, you know, non-speakers can go on mute, it'd be great. So if you think of, our provisioning ratios have always been like 50-55%, because the gross is always 2 and net was always 1. Now, what does that mean? Basically, it means that our write-off policy has been conservative for extended periods of time, and the earnings in the business are strong enough to make a neat return on equity. That's the broad thinking. Now here also, both our provisioning policy as well as write-off policy is quite conservative. So it's not that these customers are all sitting at 360 DPD or 400 DPD. Many of these customers are even earlier buckets. Second thing is that when we talk of charge-off, I just want to make one thing very, I want to simplify it to you, for you. When I say that we expect 2.5% of the average book to be charged off to the P&L, What does sacred mean? It means that that portion of the portfolio we have slipped to 90 plus or 120 plus or 150, it slipped into those respective buckets, and we have taken provisions of that amount. It's the provisions effectively that hits the P&L, and that as a divided by average book becomes. So our provisions, let me just say, starts very early. So, you know, therefore to correlate the whole thing, the write-off is not correct. Think correlated to provisions. And the provisions start early. Our own experiences, by the way, not just in the COVID. We believe COVID money that we're providing today, a good portion of it will come back. And I can't say good portion, to be fair, to my responsibilities. I can't say, I would like to edit it to say that a reasonable proportion, you know. But let me just step back from COVID. Even before COVID, continuously what we charge off, a portion of that keeps coming back. Our experience has been typically about 1 to 1.5% of the written off pool keeps coming back every month, even in normal days.
No, so Mr. Vaidyanathan, what I wanted to ask is, this quarter the credit cost was 1800, and when you say that for the overall year it's going to be around 2900 odd crores, now surely that does not include write-offs, because I mean, if you include write-offs, I mean that would itself become 3200 and write-offs
anyway. No, it includes write-offs.
Right. So, I mean, I am not getting it. So, the provision of 1800 that we have, it includes 1400 write-off. So, the net incremental provision except for the accounts written off is only 400 crores in this quarter.
Yes, yeah, so Rohit, I'll answer that. So, a write-off is generally followed by a provisioning first, right? So, when there is a 100% provisioning done on an account, then it goes into a write-off mode after certain specified days, right? So, and when you write off an account, it gets charged to P&L, and at the same time, your provision gets released because there is no incremental impact in the subsequent quarter. So,
Rohit, I think we're really confusing a lot of, you know, 200 or people on a simple, very simple concept. So, you can check, but, you know, I'll just keep it simple because I don't confuse everybody at the same time. Let me just give you a simple answer. When a customer when a customer goes to say 90 DPD, and supposing the provisioning policy of that customer base is say 25%, so that 25% at that DPD is taken to the provisioning line. Similarly, when the same customer goes to say 120 or 190 or 150 or 180, there is a certain provisioning policy. We take it to the P&L. That's a formula. End of matter. So that is what hits the P&L. Now out of that money, subsequent to its being provided, maybe a few months from then, it comes for write-off. So write-off comes from the provisioning pool. So don't double count it, and I fear it'll confuse everybody. So just leave it at that. If you have any specific doubt, you can check, but I have explained the best I could in a quickest sort of way. So think of it like a provision divided by average book is what we call, you know, in a simple sort of way, I can say the provision divided by average book is what is the credit loss. Think about it like that. Yeah, provision plus write-off.
If I can just make a last point, as you said, that the return off is only on accounts that are 100% provided, which means that the 1800 incremental that we are providing.
So it can be save everybody's life on this one technical item. It's hard to solve it on the phone. Yeah.
Last question is a strategic question, more on the strategy of growing in retail. What I wanted to understand is a lot of banks are incrementally focusing on retail. We have a lot of fintechs who are, targeting spaces which were earlier targeted by NBFCs, and a lot of NBFCs themselves are trying to become fintech. So in the backdrop of all this, I mean, I just want to understand what is the, you know, consumer base that, let's say, still remains attractive. How far do you think we have headroom to grow our retail book in a manner which is going to keep our yields where they are? So just wanted to understand strategically, where do you see retail heading given the onslaught of fintechs, and also the fact that some of these bigger banks are now focusing on the retail segment?
See, first of all, we are also a reasonably, digital company. We work ahead. Secondly, let me just say that the businesses we're building are, like, can go on and on beyond my life and your lives. It's never going to end. This is, as of now, you know, for us, our own the feeling is that for us to grow at 25% year on year on year on year, like for a long time is not a problem at all. Basically, there are two big games being played out in India. One is the extent of, you know, formalization of the economy is happening. So people who are not borrowing from the formal market are now coming to the formal market and taking from the market. And secondly, there are people who don't take credit at all are also coming and taking credit because of, you know, they're coming of age or they're coming to the working pool or whatever. So this game is not going to stop. So we don't, at least for our bank, I can put that to rest. I think we can grow at 25% like really for a long time. You think of a, you know, really good bank like, you know, an ICICI bank or an HDFC bank or, you know, think of any other good bank in India. And look at them. They are like 5 lakh crores is ICICI bank's retail book or a little more than that. And they're still growing at 20%. You look at SBI, maybe 30 lakh crores still growing. So, we are only, by any standard, 70,000 crores is nothing. That's the start of the game.
Fair enough. And this growth, I'm assuming, is purely, let's say, driven by your own gains and not so dependent on GDP growth? Or is there also an element of 25% being contingent on, growth being around, let's say, 7% or something like that?
It depends on how big you are. If you are really India's largest bank with, you know, some that sort of a market share of having a that size of a book, then you'll say, look, I depend on the economy. But when you're coming on a really small book, I call 70,000 really small, by the way. It's nothing. So when you're coming up this book, for you to grow at 25%, 30% is nothing. You know, you see the large NBFC in India, which is probably 1.5 lakh crore. They're also growing. So it depends on, the size. We're still very small. For us, growth is not the issue. Our bigger thing to watch out for is to make sure that our credit quality is consistent. You know, we've had a long track record of having very stable asset quality of gross NPA of 2 and net NPA of 1. It's like 10 years. It is our response, our wish is to hold it at, again, back, except when the COVID wave goes through, to bring it back 2 and 1 and sustain it that for like ever and ever. That would be a wish. So credit quality is the criteria to watch out for. The second thing is to watch out for in this game is to keep our unit operating cost economics in a way that it continuously generates return on equity of, let me say, high teens, like 18, 20-ish, and at least on the retail side, on the lending side. So those kind of things, and of course, you know, those kind of things. But really, growth is not the issue for us.
Sure. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Anand Dama from MK Global. Please go ahead.
Yes, sir. Thank you for the opportunity. Sir, on your retail portfolio, so when we really look at our retail portfolio at this point of time, seems to be little on a higher risk side as well as, you know, it is giving us good margins as well. I understand that basically we are getting some benefit on the cost of fund side. So how do you see the portfolio mix changing going forward in terms of products? Going forward, we have already launched cards and we are also doing PL, but not in a big way as such at this point of time. So how will this really portfolio product mix will look like over the next 2 to 3 years? If you can just talk about that, that would be great. Particularly now that we have the experience of COVID as well.
See, the way we think about it, that our big growth area will definitely be home loans. And see, home loans, even before we were a bank, we were very good at affordable housing, at pretty good, pretty low NPA. Even just because affordable doesn't mean it's high NPA and all that. It's not true. We had pretty low NPA, low gross, low net, not much credit loss, etc. Affordable. So that was what we were doing. But now the moment we started entered into the prime home loan market, we are finding fantastic response. That has made us very, very happy. So the core home loan will continue to grow. The other businesses, of course, if you ask us to pick which would be the fastest growing, I'd say, yeah, home loan would be the fastest growing. Second fastest growing probably will be our SME loans, and SME meaning business installment loans, maybe loan against property, these kind of loans. Our rural business is a big growth area. We are, again, I must say, we are really small. We are probably just about 13% of our book, of our 75,000 crore book, is rural. And imagine the size of rural. So rural is going to be a big area for us. We are short of PSL, and we hope to grow rural to meet our PSL requirements. Short of PSL meaning we're buying PSL in the market. We are not self-sufficient. So to that extent, we will grow rural. That should grow a little bit faster than our rest of the book. Our credit card book, of course, a newly launched book, so it could grow. So these are a few businesses that could grow ahead of the rest. And of course, the rest of the business will continue to grow.
So the mixed
sense will be more home loan and home loan biased, let me say.
But will the home loan be somewhere about 30-40% of our book?
Yes, eventually in the long run, definitely. I think we'll become a 40% home loan bank in the long run. That's because, you know, home loan has a tendency, mortgages, if you want to be more safer than that, home loan and LAP, etc. put together. But comfortably we'll be 40% and maybe 60% will be others. Because I think the key thing or dynamic about mortgage is that it tends to stay on your books for long because it's a long tenure loan and others have a pretty short runoff. So you got to work harder and harder to grow the other books, and mortgage tends to just grow linearly.
Yes, sir. And so in that case, basically, there will be a trade-off in terms of margins because now we have, you know, the peak margin that we are seeing at this point of time. So where do you think these margins will actually settle in next 2 to 3 years?
No, you know, it's a trade-off both sides actually. So definitely you're right in a margin sense. It's a trade-off where you have a lesser margin in a home, but it also have an operating cost. You see the other businesses that we run, that is two-wheelers and consumer durables and credit cards and all the other businesses, they tend to, of course, give you a good yield, but the operating cost of the business is like pretty high, 6 to 8% depending on business we're in. A home loan office could be very low. Look at HDFC's home loan book when it's fully evolved. Cost income of 17%. Can you beat that? So you have a benefit, of course, in terms of a negative trade-off as far as yield is concerned, but there's a positive trade-off in OPEX to average book.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So secondly, in terms of your retail portfolio, you know, you do give basically the new to bank customers and those kind of data. Is it possible for you to give more qualitative and granular details in terms of your retail customers, be it customer scores as such? Because, you know, I think all of us basically we have concern about the portfolio that we bring on our book, particularly on the retail front, and we are seeing higher write-offs coming through. So if you can give some comfort in terms of the customers that we have at this point of time, what kind of portfolio that we have actually built over the past 2 to 3 years, how it is going to really look like going forward, that will be very helpful.
Okay, if that's helpful, I'll give you a ready-made answer because the slide is in front of me. So let me just put it like that. Directionally where we're headed. Now think Capital First is born, let me say, in 2010 or 12, and think that a borrowing cost is 14%. And what do you do to lend, to make a living? What do? You lend at 24%.
Yeah.
You lend at 24. Now, who will borrow 24 from you?
Yeah, certainly the risky customer.
Exactly. So at that point of time, when we started the business, at that point of time, we're starting from a 94 crore rupee book, so obviously we were lending to everybody, almost everybody we were lending to were probably people who did not have any bureau score. And that's where we learned our trade, let me say, by playing in those waters. Now, as the cost of funds kept down, coming down to 12, 11 and so on, we started the ability to play in the safer segment. I mean, safer compared to everything is a relative. So safer compared to what it was in 2010, 11, 12, 13. And then we started lending about 25% of our book was new to credit. That is around 2017, 18 or so. I mean, I'm approximately maybe a year here. In January to June 2019, 17% of our book was new to credit. In June to December 19, 16% of our customers are new to book. In January 21 to June 21, 10% of our customers is new to credit. So if you see the trend line, you can see clearly see that as our cost of funds is getting better and we can be more competitive, we are doing more, we're taking lesser of new to credit customers. And anyway, as a bank, I'd say that it's expected of us to be a little more, you know, banking license as a sacred thing. And we've got to, you know, it feels more comfortable moving to safer and safer credits. But directionally, you could see where the number is headed from the, you know, 20s to the 10. The second thing is that gives you, helps you color in that is the set number of customers whose bureau score is greater than 700. So even as recently as Jan 19 to June 19, 61% of our customers had a bureau score of greater than 700 and 39% had a bureau score of less than 700. And by the way, even that is a good portfolio priced for itself. It's not that it's a bad portfolio. It's just that the economics, I described how it worked. When we're talking in Jan to June 21, as in the latest 6 months that have gone by, 83% of our customers is now greater than 700 score. This is, I'm talking all urban, by the way. So 61 to 83 in 2 years. So you can see that we are moving. As the cost of funds is getting better, we are moving to safer credit. That doesn't mean, you know, our economics of ROE goes away. It's just that our cost of funds come down, yield is lower, credit cost is lesser. It's just the way it is. But I hope that gave you a color about what we're doing.
Yeah, certainly. But then basically, if these basically customers, you know, who are there even existing to credit, you know, if they are lending somewhere about 90% of existing to credit, but if these customers are of a weak profile, then certainly the tendency of them to turn into you know, defaulters is very high, right? So if you can put out some data in presentation and which can be tracked, I think, over a period of time, that will be very, very helpful.
No, it's already there, by the way. In page number 12, we already described the numbers, what I've told you right now. It's already there in page
12. If you can. So the way you basically put out the scores, you know, for 700 and above, and that kind of data can be captured at Google.
No, I'm saying it's there. If you see the page 12, you'll find it. The 683% customers having score greater than 700 is there in the data. So, and we'll present the data going forward also. The short point is that as the years are rolling by, we are of course becoming a little more, if you were to put it so, if that's an appropriate word, we're getting a little more conservative. I'd say it's a good thing for the bank in the longer run. But that doesn't mean we want to let go of our capabilities built over 10 years, but we want to do it in moderation.
And sir, lastly, if you can help us in terms of, you know, we had this refund fee where the holdco and the, you know, subsidiary can be merged. So any update on that front, how is it going to take forward?
So basically, if your question is, are we, with regard to the holdco and the RBI, planning to come out, and if that's the question, there is absolutely no discussion at this point of time.
Even at the holdco level?
No.
Okay. Sure, sir. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, due to time constraint, we will take that as a last question. I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Kunal Shah for closing comments.
Thanks, Mr. Vaidyanathan and the entire senior management team of IDFC First Bank for such a comprehensive and exhaustive explanation to all the questions on results as well as strategy. And thanks all the participants for being there on the call. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. It was nice speaking to all of you.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, thanks. Have a nice weekend. Yeah.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of ICICI Securities Limited, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.